Gospel of Luke today. And before we start talking about that, let me ask a couple questions. First and foremost, how many people here have ever experienced a major disappointment in their life? Okay, so it's a whole room full of human beings. How many have experienced that disappointment as a result of asking God to intervene, asking for something in prayer, and that having not been answered, or seemingly not been answered? That's pretty much all of us. How did you feel? How do you feel? What goes through your mind when you pray for something and it doesn't seem to be answered? Anybody? That God doesn't hear you?
Frustrated.
That what?
Frustrated.
What did I hear? I heard something else over here. Did I hear mad? And what?
Failed.
And like you feel like a failure in all of these kinds of things at times? A lot of different things that we have to process through when we experience something like that, right? Something that we had prayed for, hoping that God would intervene, and nothing seems to come from it. This morning, as we come back to our study in Luke chapter 1, we're going to be introduced to people who have just that experience and who very well may have been going through all of those various things that we express here, all those different things that we feel in the face of disappointment. If you have a Bible with you, if you'll turn to Luke chapter 1, please. Last week we read the introduction, the first four verses. We considered a few of the reasons why this account was written, what was the motive for it. Now today we're going to get to the actual beginning of the story. And you know, the fact that the Bible comes to us in story form is actually so important. That's almost as important as the truth that story tells us. Because God wants to draw us into His action. The Bible, you know, is not just a series of moral codes. It's not just a collection of theological premises. It's a story. It comes to us as a story. And I believe that's important because God is trying to invite us in, bring us into the story, wants to draw us into His action through history concerning the future, and especially as it touches our present moment. The story form is meant to shape the way that we understand life, the way we understand our past, the way we anticipate the future, and the way we live right now. A story has a beginning, and it has a middle, and it has an end, but above all, a story has a plot. And that's one of the things that we as human beings struggle with most of all, I would think, that we sometimes have a tendency to lose sight of the plot. God's doing something. God's unfolding something. And those are things that we have to keep in mind as we experience life. As we read this story of Jesus, we're going to find as we go that we're in this story. We're actually included in this. As we read it and take it in, we're going to find ourselves journeying towards God, moving towards His plans and purposes as we get caught in the currents of this gospel story. We're going to be able to see ourselves as we consider the characters that we examine and the things that they experience, and we can learn from them. We can learn about ourselves and the life that we live. Now, this morning, we're going to see ourselves as we see one couple who faced a lot of disappointment in their lives. And so let's just begin this morning by picking up where we left off. And I want to start by reading verses 5-7 in this account. This is still Luke, and this is still his introduction, basically. And he says in verse 5, "In the days of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah of the division of Abijah. And he had a wife from the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God, walking blamelessly in all the commands and statutes of the Lord. But they had no child because Elizabeth was barren, and both were advanced in years." Okay, this opening sequence that we begin with here is often called the gospel overture. It's sort of like Luke is saying, I'm going to tell you the story of Jesus, but before I tell you his story, I got to go back and actually tell you about another guy and his story and how it affected everything else as it unfolds. He plays an important role. Luke, wanting to be a good historian, provides a reference to a time period for us by telling us that he's starting this story back during the days of Herod, the king of Judea. Now, this would have been a man, you can flip that slide if you will, please. This would have been a man known in history as Herod the Great. At least he called himself the Great, which kind of tells us a little bit of who he was just in that. We need to remember his moniker. We need to remember that he was referred to as Herod the Great at that time and through history, because that will be something that comes up a little bit later on. But he was in power between the years of 37 BC to 4 BC. So somewhere within that time frame is when this story begins. Now, Herod wasn't really a king in the sense that he was sovereign or that he had any kind of sovereign power in Palestine. He was still part of the Roman Empire, so he always had to answer to Rome for anything. He could never make any decisions independently of Rome. And history's not very kind in remembering this man. He's remembered as a power-hungry, very brutal man. And you know, the people of Israel didn't like him because he was a puppet governor. He was a puppet ruler under Rome. In order to try to gain the favor of all of the people of Palestine, he did a lot of building projects, did a lot of things to try to make people like him. Built the great port in Caesarea. He actually finished out the temple in Jerusalem, made a beautiful, magnificent structure there. But all in all, everybody still didn't like him, which is more than likely why Luke doesn't refer to him as Herod the Great, because he doesn't want to alienate his readers right off the bat. Nobody thought he was great. So he's kind of like saying, in the days of Herod, not the Herod the Great, but Herod the Feh. But now he is not who this story is about. That's what's kind of interesting here. He's just a point of reference. If we were making a movie of this, we would be looking at Herod the Great and seeing his place in history, and then the camera would just pan away from him and land on this old backwoods priest and his childless and most probably postmenopausal wife. And we would kind of look at that and think, why are we here, Luke? Who cares about these people? And Luke tells us in this, he says, oh, they're good people. They're really good people. They're very devout, observant Jewish people. And we'd be like, yeah, so? And he'd be like, oh, that's important. You'll see. It's an important part of the story. Now, this falls into place with so many of the characters of the Old Testament. Once again, Luke is trying to make sure that we get the connection between what was prophesied before, what was taking place before in the Old Covenant, and what is fulfilled in Christ. We've got characters like Abraham and Sarah, Jacob and Rebecca, Hannah. We've got Samson's parents, all of these who were people who were childless, who, when they had a child, that person was a significant part of the story that was being put together by God. Now, the text tells us that they walked blamelessly. And we don't want to make the mistake of thinking that that text is trying to say that they were somehow sinless, only that they were very sincere in their devotion to God and in their practice of Judaism. The reason he's saying that, the reason he's putting that in there, is because it's an important detail that we might not catch right off the bat. Because in that time and in that culture, people would have often assumed that Zach and Beth's infertility was a result of some sin hidden somewhere in their life, that they weren't able to have children and it was God's judgment on them. In fact, that was a very common assumption made during that time period. And so Luke is wanting to make sure that we understand right off the bat, this has nothing to do with some sort of sin or anything like that. These were good people. They spent their lives serving God. But in spite of that, they still lived with this lifetime of disappointment and shame. Shame? Yeah, absolutely shame. In that time, in that culture, a woman who was childless was actually considered a disgrace. She would have been considered a disgrace by the family, a disgrace by the community. In fact, it was even written into the law that Zechariah had the option to divorce her if he wanted to because she didn't bear him a son. That was well within his rights. How beautiful is it then that as an old couple, they're still there together. He stayed with her and their love transcended that. But, you know, there was a practical side to that. We can look at that culture and say, wow, how mean, how cold-hearted. But there was a certain pragmatism in that because without children, there was A, going to be nobody to carry on his name. But even more important than that, as they got into an age where they were going to be more dependent on other people, there was no one to care for them. Because this was a day and age, remember. This is way before there was any sort of, you know, Social Security or Medicare or even hospice. When a person gets to a certain age where they're in need of assistance and help, and if you don't have kids, you're on your own. You're sunk in that situation. And so they'd been praying, obviously, you know they would have been, praying and praying, God, provide us the son, provide us the children that we need. Praying, and you know, now it was too late. Now they're too old to have kids. You talk about disappointment. I mean, you talk about heaven feeling as though it's silent, as though no one's listening. All those feelings that we mentioned earlier, you figure those would have been feelings that would have haunted this couple day in and day out through all of their adult lives in their married life together. There's a lot of disappointments that we face in this life. Maybe somebody even this morning is like that couple, wanting a child, wanting to be able to have children of their own, but not able to conceive. Maybe a person's single and desperately wanting to be married and praying for a mate, and it doesn't seem to have happened. Maybe somebody is married, and it's not exactly what they were hoping it was going to be. You laughed way too loud on that, Brenda. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. Hank and Brenda, they're doing great. But anyway, but there's all kinds of disappointments that we face in this life. Maybe it's an illness that just doesn't seem to go away, that just continues to cling to us. Maybe it's in this economic climate, the loss of a job or a house or both. And like Zach and Beth, we pray and we pray, asking God to intervene, asking God to help, but heaven sends no answer to us. Well, this story, right off the bat, tells us something important for us to keep in mind, something important to factor in as we begin the process of coping with our disappointment, and that is a failure to receive an answer that we want does not mean that God is punishing us. That's what Luke sets off right at the outset here. Now, I don't want you guys to think that Zach and Beth did something wrong. They were good people. This was just something that happened. The fact is, stupid stuff happens to good people all the time. I mean, it happened all through the scriptures. It happens all through history. We've got to break the habit of making that assessment and assuming that God's mad at us when something goes wrong or we don't get an answer to prayer. It doesn't seem that our prayer is answered. Or you could say, well, yeah, then why doesn't God just answer my prayer then, Rob? Why does he answer? Why does he stay quiet? Well, I believe he does answer. He does answer. It's just that it's not always the way we want. It's not always the way we expect it to come to us. And quite frankly, we just got to face it. Sometimes God's answer is there, and it's just no. His answer is no. We're even told in the scriptures, sometimes that's because our prayers are amiss. We're asking amiss. Oh, God, please, just crush my enemies. I'm going to have to say no to that one. Oh, God, I just can't live if I don't get a better job. Really? I think you'll live. In fact, I got something to show you. Come on, it's going to be all right. The perceived silence from heaven does not mean that we're on God's bad side, that God's ignoring us because he doesn't like us anymore, or that we're being punished, or that we're even being corrected. Now, does God ever use circumstances to correct us? Yes, he does. We know that from Hebrews 12. C.S. Lewis calls pain God's megaphone. He'll use that at times to get our attention. But if that's the case, we're going to know what it's about. We're going to know why it's happening. He's not playing games with us. God's not in this little cosmic thing where he's having fun at our expense. What kind of a parent would walk up to the kid and just smack him and say, now you figure out what that's for? That'd be a terrible parent. But God's a good parent. God will make it clear in our conscience. If we're suffering in order to get our attention, we'll know what it's about. We'll know why. So if times are hard and heaven is silent, don't despair. If your conscience is clear, we know where we stand with God. Don't despair. God's not ignoring us. God's not punishing us. Sometimes life goes stupid for good people in a broken world. We've got to accept that reality. That's just the reality that we live in now. Now, one day, God's going to put it all back in order. God's going to make it the way he intended it to be. But in the time being, we've got to face the facts. Sometimes things just are not pleasant. They don't go well. It has nothing to do with being right or wrong before God. And sometimes, as we're going to see in this story, heaven is silent, which means that the answer is actually not now, but later. Let's keep reading here, verses 8 to 10. It says, now while he was serving as a priest before God when his division was on duty, according to the custom of the priesthood, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and burn incense. And the whole multitude of the people were praying outside at the hour of incense. Okay, we'll stop there. To get an understanding of what's taking place here, Zechariah was one of anywhere between 18 to 20,000 priests in Judea at that time. That's a lot. There was a lot of people who were from the priestly lineage who were qualified to do the duties, the operations of the worship services within the temple at appointed feast days and stuff. Now, you can't have 20,000 priests operating in the temple at the same time. There'd be no room for anything else. It'd just be wall-to-wall priests and nobody could get anything done. So back in the days of King David, when that number was rising like that, they organized all the priests into 24 different divisions. So that each could have a chance and an opportunity to be able to serve at a different time. So each of these divisions would serve in the temple for 1 week, two times a year. And out of that division, when they would be called up to go up, you know, you kind of think of it like, the reserve forces. You get called up, you get taken on duty for a while, and then you go back. So out of each division, they would cast lots to see who was going to go into the temple and actually perform the various duties. As in this case, where a priest would go in, put the incense on the altar, speak a prayer, a blessing over Israel, and then reemerge and speak a blessing over the multitude that was waiting there for them. So this was something a person was able to do only one time in their lifetime. Think about that for just a moment. Out of all these priests in Israel, this is the period of time where Zechariah's division goes up. And as they're all standing around there, he's waited his whole life. He's an old guy. He only has this chance once in his lifetime. And so basically they throw the dice and it lands and says, oh, it's your turn this time, Zechariah. You're the one who's going to go in here. Now here's what the temple looked like back in Zechariah's day. This is an artistic rendering. You can find it over on the ESV Bible website. What would have happened here is that Zechariah would have gone up these stairs. The whole multitude of people would be in this courtyard. There's a court right in front of this to the gate, beautiful. And so in this courtyard, all these people would be gathered around the temple proper. He would have gone up these stairs into the main chamber, which was called the holy place. And right in at the end of that main chamber, there was a huge, thick curtain that separated that chamber from a smaller chamber called the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant used to be before the Babylonian exile. And there was, we've got it circled there, was a little altar right there in front of this massive curtain where he would go in, the priest would go in, and he would put incense down on coals that would be there. He'd probably take the coals and the incense together, pour them on, and that would fill the room up with this smell of incense. So up Zechariah goes in this once-in-a-lifetime experience to burn this incense and to pray for Israel. And it looks as though he's a guy who's kind of, you know, been rolling with whatever haphazard luck comes his way. Even in this situation, well, finally, you know, the roll of the dice works for me. And everything about this story gives you a sense that maybe there was just a randomness to the whole affair. But we're going to find out that even in the casting of that dice, that God was in there. God's the one tipping it over the way he wants it to be in order to tell his story. So we get here to verse 11. And it says, and there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And Zechariah was troubled when he saw him, and fear fell upon him. But the angel said to him, don't be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard, and your wife, Elizabeth, will bear you a son, and you shall call his name Yohanan, or John, if you must. And you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth. For he'll be great before the Lord, and he must not drink wine or strong drink, and he'll be filled with the Holy Spirit, even from his mother's womb. And he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God. And he will go before him in the spirit and power of Eliab, Elijah, and turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, and make ready for the Lord a people prepared. Okay, so Luke gives us details here of this encounter that are details that could have only come to us from Zechariah, from Zach himself, his firsthand experiences, even down to where the angel is standing. He's standing to the right of the altar. In other words, a place, a position of blessing on him. What did the angel look like? Boy, wouldn't those details have been nice? That's the main stuff. I don't really care where he was standing. I'd like to know what he looked like, but, you know, maybe that's the artist in me or whatever, but that part is left out. This sudden appearance of this being and maybe the way he looks frightens old Zechariah. You know, we're lucky he didn't just have a heart attack right there on the spot and fall over. You know, this is the most common kind of response in the Bible to the appearance of an angelic being. You know, we see those shows like Touched by an Angel and everybody, oh, I love angels and stuff like that. But in reality, people are more likely to poop their pants when they encounter an angel than they are anything else. I mean, really, honestly, in the Bible, in the record of this, I mean, people are falling down. They're getting sick. You know, they're fainting all over the place. Personally, I have no desire to meet up with an angel anywhere along the way. But most people don't have any say about this, as in Zach's case. Now, the first thing that the angel says, right after he says, now, don't freak out, is he says something so important. He says, your prayer has been heard. Let that sink in just for a moment. Think about who this is that he's saying this to. Think about this old man and his wife who've been praying and praying and praying, and year after year after year after year has ticked by with nothing seeming to happen. And the first words that this angel says to him is, don't sweat it, man. God has heard your prayer. Oh, there's something so important for us to remember that in that concerning disappointment. That alone should comfort us, because no matter what we hear, God always hears us. No matter how well we're able to receive something, transmission from Him, no matter how much static there seems to be in the airwaves when we're trying to zero in on what He's saying, He always, always hears us. No matter what we see happening in the circumstances around us, He always hears us. God had heard Zach and Beth, and as we see from what the angel announces here, He heard the prayers of all of Israel concerning the Messiah that they were longing for. Scott, on the Wonder What site, the blog site that we have, wrote this in the comments. He said, interesting that a personal prayer was answered while he was performing a service for the public. The angel didn't appear while he was praying quietly in his own house. And I love that picture. The reality that even in the face of all of this disappointment that he received in his personal life, his heart was still to serve. He was still out there doing what he'd been called to do, serving others. And in the process of serving others, God reveals what it is that he's going to do in his life. There was something bigger going on than just Zach's desires, but they were also an important part of it too. There was a big story unfolding, a huge plot that was being fulfilled here, and it was bigger than just Zachariah's desire and need for a child, and yet that need and that desire was actually part of it as well. And God promises to provide a miracle of biblical proportions, which is cool because it is in the Bible anyway. But this aged, infertile couple is going to have a son. Amazing. Woot! It's just incredible stuff. But not only that, he says this son is going to be great. And that's important that he uses that phrase, because in the days when Herod was king of Judea, in days of Herod the Great, this angel says, nah, Herod, feh, John, oh, he's going to be great. He's going to be great in the eyes of the Lord, which is what makes it all so important right there. And this is a serious bit of irony that's being applied that we're going to see reoccurring all through this gospel. This contrast between the governments of this world and the way we try to set up a kingdom of man and the kingdom of God and how it works and presses in and overlaps the kingdoms of this world. And so he says this son's going to be the herald of a new age for Israel. It's going to be a spiritual awakening that comes when this child comes. He's going to be set apart to God even from birth, filled with the Spirit, an unlikely, unusual thing. The Spirit of God would come upon prophets of old, but here he's going to be filled with the Spirit, marking a new way in which God's doing things. He's going to follow the strict practices of the Nazarite concerning alcohol. We read about that in Numbers 6. He's going to have this strict separation, that is, from pleasures. because his joy is going to be so complete. It's going to be much like Samson in that, which connects it again to the old story, the story from the old covenant. The other thing about this is he's going to come in the spirit and power of Elijah, the forerunner of the Messiah. In the last book of the Old Testament, in the book of Malachi, written 400 years before this event, a prophet, a cryptic prophet, comes and makes this statement that seems to leave all Israel hanging, saying that Elijah's going to come before the Messiah shows up, and he'll prepare the way for it. Well, you know, 400 years go by, and everybody's sitting there thinking about Elijah. When's Elijah going to show up? When's Elijah going to be here? To the point where they actually begin to obsess about Elijah. In that 400-year period, Elijah takes on mythical proportions in their worldview. They're all excited about Messiah, almost to the point that they lose sight of the Messiah. But here, this angel saying that thing that everybody's looking for, the coming of Elijah, he's going to be fulfilled through your son. This son that you guys are not able to have is going to be the one who's going to usher in this new age for Israel, this new world that's going to be unveiled through this. This is an answer to Zach's prayer. This is an answer to all of Israel's prayer. God's unfolding his plan. So in the face of disappointment, here's another comfort that we draw from that, and that is, even in the face of unanswered prayer, we have to remember that God has a plan unfolding. Just because it's not happening the way we anticipated, just because we're not getting exactly what we had asked for at this moment of time, the moment of time that we're trapped in, we can't be anywhere else, doesn't mean that God's not got his plan unfolding in the background in places that we can't see. The angel's telling Zach that God's going to use this lifelong disappointment that he and his wife had endured to reveal himself in a whole new way. Think about the disappointments that we experience from that perspective for a moment. See, we don't want to give up on God. We don't want to give up on ourselves or give up believing or holding out hope just because things haven't happened on our timetable or the way we wanted them to happen doesn't mean that God has stopped working. Doesn't mean that he's clocked out or he's ignoring us now in this. We have to hold on to the hope that God has a plan in all of these things. No matter what we see, we have to hold out that hope. God's got a plot that's unfolding according to his plans and purposes. The greatest disappointment that Zechariah and Elizabeth, that they faced in their life, becomes the source of the greatest miracle this couple will ever know. Think about our disappointments in light of that. We need to see our disappointments as the potential for God revealing himself to us in brand new ways, in ways we never could have expected. Okay, so now the story is going to take a kind of a comical turn, and we don't need to be afraid of letting the Bible be humorous where it wants to be. And in the original text of this, I'm sure everybody was getting a chuckle at the next part that unfolds here. Because if you were making a movie of this, what you would do is as the angel is talking about the great ministry that John's going to have, how he's going to be great and prepare the way for the Messiah, you'd get the orchestra swelling and the music would be building to a crescendo. And then you'd get to verse 18 and it would be kind of like a record scratch across it, like that. And we get here to verse 18 and it says, "And Zechariah said to the angel, 'How shall I know this? For I'm an old man and my wife is advanced in years.' And the angel answered him, 'I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God. And I was sent to speak to you and bring you this good news. And behold, you'll be silent and unable to speak until the day that these things take place, because you didn't believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time.'" So it didn't require Zechariah's faith to make this happen. God was going to do what he was going to do. So here's Zechariah. He's standing all alone in this sacred place. There's, as best we can tell, there's only small little openings for light that would come into that main chamber. So it's by and large a dark room apart from the incense, the coals on the incense that he put there, and the candle, the lampstand that would have been back behind him to his left. apart from that. He's in this darkened room, and all of a sudden, here's this cosmic being who appears. There's only one entrance, in and out, you know, one way in or out into this building. And all of a sudden, here's this person standing there before him, you know, telling him he's going to have a son. Now, 2,000 years after the experience, we like to pick on Zechariah. We like to look at him and go, oh, well, he didn't have any faith. Or, man, terrible. But honestly, I absolutely love his response here. I really do. This record of his response is so human and so believable that it actually lends weight to the story, at least from my sake. When I look at this and I realize that he's reacting the way a human being would react, I think, well, that lends credence to this. The Bible never populates its stories with people who have no trouble believing God. It never does that. It's actually just the opposite of that. You had 66 books of people who are puzzled and tentative and, you know, shrugging their shoulders. Was that God? I mean, it's all over the place. It's exactly what you'd expect real people to do when faced with incredible, amazing circumstances. That's what I love about it. Zechariah is a real guy, and he's flabbergasted. Not only is he startled and frightened by what it is he's seeing before his eyes, but what he's hearing makes him incredulous as well. I mean, you think about what it is that's being promised, a son to him in his old age, from his wife who's old as well. He's probably thinking, what was in that incense anyway? What are we smoking in here? You know, he looks at this angel and he's bold enough to actually question his sanity. I mean, that's what he's doing. It's, how will I know that? He's saying, say what? How is that going to happen? How is that possible? How are two old folks like us going to be able to do that? Have you ever heard of menopause, fella? I can tell you all about it because I've lived with it in my house. I mean, there's, you know, as if he's trying to correct the angel, as if he's anticipating that the angel somehow is going to go, Oh, wait, you're how old? You know, I'm sorry, I've never been good with ages. We all look alike in heaven. What's your name again? Let me make sure I got... No, the thing about it is the angel actually retorts. They actually sort of scolds him in the process, and the result of it is a corrective impairment. That is, Gabe says because he didn't believe the message that was told him, because he was refusing, in essence, to believe this message sent to him, that he was now going to suffer this corrective impairment. Brad, on the Wonder What site, had an interesting take on this. He said, reading Zechariah's story, I feel I can relate to his reaction. Almost like a knee-jerk reaction. He says, what? How? And then the angel says, don't doubt me, now you're mute. And I imagine Zechariah's first instinct would be, I'm not doubting you, I just don't know how this can be done. In other words, doubt can take an unexpected form. Sometimes I don't even realize when I'm doubting God. Sometimes I don't consider it a lack of faith, it's just me, you know, wondering how on earth things could ever work out. It's like a child looking at some gooey cake batter, trying to touch it when his mother isn't looking. Are you sure that's going to be cake? Doesn't look like a cake. And then mom sends him to his room because his lack of faith just put a dirty child finger into the batter. And you know, it gives us sort of a lesson here. As we look at what happens here, a failure to trust God in the face of disappointment can sometimes have corrective consequences. God's whole purpose seems to be to get us as human beings to trust him. And sometimes that failure to trust him in the face of those disappointments can cause him to have to get our attention in other ways. You can flip that slide, please. God's desire for our lives is to get us to put our confidence in him, to believe that he hears us, to believe that he cares for us, and to believe that he's got a plan. And you know the whole thing about him caring for us? Sometimes that's the whole thing right there. Sometimes that's where everything gets stuck. We had really good responses on Wonder What. Listen to what Chris had to say about that. Maybe Zechariah had gotten so used to reproach from the community, wondering why, for so long that he started to doubt himself and his own worthiness. Maybe he felt like, who, me? How could he do this for me? Seriously? It's kind of hard to doubt a bright, shining angel right there in your face, or at least I think it would be. It's easy to doubt your own worthiness of blessing from God, though. That's so true, and yet it's still the very doubt that ends up causing Zechariah to face this corrective impairment. This wasn't a judgment on Zechariah. This was like mom sending the kid to the room. I want you to go and think about what you've done there. Think about what's just taken place here. See, doubt isn't just doubting that God can do something. It's also doubt not to believe God will do something because he cares about us, because he has a plan for us. It's like all through the word, the message that keeps coming to us. I love you. I've heard you. I have a plan for you. If you refuse to believe me, I'll have to get your attention some other way. Now, in Zechariah's case, it was something to get him to shut up long enough so that God could prove that he had a plan in place, that he was up to something. Sometimes God will allow things to get our attention, just as we said earlier. And here's a case in point. But if he does, we're going to know why. We're going to know what it's all about. Gabe spells it out for him plainly. You wouldn't believe, so this is why this is happening. And so this part of the story finishes up here, starting in verse 21. It says, "And the people were waiting for Zechariah, and they were wondering at his delay in the temple. And when he came out, he was unable to speak to them, and they realized that he'd seen a vision in the temple. And he kept making signs to them and remained mute. And when his time of service was ended, he went to his home. After these days, his wife Elizabeth conceived, and for 5 months she kept herself hidden, saying, 'Thus the Lord has done for me in the days when he looked on me to take away my reproach among people.'" You know what I take out of this final section? Concerning disappointment, that disappointment is reversed when we look for God's purpose in our life. The moment we begin to see this along the lines of the plot, disappointment can begin to be alleviated. You figure, in this case, Zechariah is taking a long time coming out from the temple. He was supposed to go in, put the incense on there, say his prayer, then come back out and finish with a blessing on the people. So all the people, you figure like hundreds, maybe even 1,000 people gathered in that courtyard all around the temple proper, waiting. Maybe some of the more pious people were genuflecting, had gotten down on their knees to show their adoration of God. And time goes on and time goes on and time goes on. And some people are thinking, you know, God, I love you and all, but this marble is hard on my knees. And will you hurry that guy up? You can figure the guys from his division are probably thinking, you know, you can't do anything right, can you? All you got to do is just go in and put the incense on, mumble a few prayers, and get back out here. Get this show on the road. And time just goes on and on. People are looking at the little sundial on their wrist, and nothing's happening, and nothing's happening. And finally, when he does emerge from the temple, they're saying, "What took you so long?" And he can't say anything. He's just standing there, you know, doing this. And some of the more astute people around him right away recognize something's happened to him. Something took place in that. He's had an ecstatic experience of some kind, and they ascribe it to a vision. He must have seen something, a vision of some kind. And all Zach can do, it says in this, is use his hands to try to pantomime what it is that happened to him in there. How do you do that? How do you pantomime that you've just seen an angel? Something like that. Hey, you ran into a sparrow? No, I think he's saying he's batty or something. I don't know. But he goes out there. He obviously doesn't do a good job of explaining it, because they're saying, "Oh, he had a vision or something." I don't know. The guy's nuts. And he stays on the job. I love this, that he stays on the job until the time of service is over, too. He doesn't take a leave of absence. He just stays there. And so he's got a whole week to sit and ruminate over what has happened to him, what this experience was all about. A week that he couldn't explain to anyone what had taken place. A week where people are saying, "Well, are you okay?" And yet, just as the angel says, when that week is up, he goes home, and obviously he and the wife get busy, and she gets pregnant. And it's not clear from the text exactly why Elizabeth hides away for 5 months. Someone this morning was saying to me that, you know, especially for a first-time pregnancy, that it would have been a while before her body would have begun to show this. And this was a very special time for her. This woman was explaining that was a very special time for her in her life, touched with this life that only she herself could touch, united with the soul of somebody else. it's hard to say. Maybe, you know, she was just stoked because she had a mute husband. And, you know, she was doing some shopping or something. She's online buying stuff for the new nursery and saying, I'm going to buy a crib. Just yell if you don't want me to. I'll take that as a yes and charge it. But it's hard to say exactly what it was. More than likely, it's possible that she just wanted God to be the one doing the talking about what God has done. In other words, instead of just trying to erase her own reproach by going out and telling everybody what was going to happen, she was going to let God do the talking. She was going to let God show to everyone what had taken place in her life. And there's something really interesting in this. She's going to let God's purposes be revealed then in His time, according to His timetable and His purposes. Even though in everybody else's eyes, because her husband's not talking and she's hidden herself away, in everybody else's eyes, the reproach was still in place. Nothing had actually changed. But God had done something that was impossible to do. And when His purposes were revealed, all of those disappointments that she and her husband had faced all through those years fell into the proper perspective. We're able to be seen in light of the plot. See, we, like ancient Israel, were waiting for God to break in on the scene. Ancient Israel was waiting for the Messiah to come the first time. We're waiting for His return, but we're still anticipating, waiting for God to break in. And God is working towards that purpose. And all of our stories are involved in that. And all of those things are working towards that main goal. All of the different disappointments that we face, they're so much like what Zach and Beth faced in their lives. And the story here has so much more to do with the bigger picture than just the joy that that family had by having a son. It's about the fulfillment of God's promises that were happening in their lives, but it still didn't negate the fact that God was working through this very thing. The needs, the hopes, the fears of ordinary people are not forgotten in the larger story, in the bigger plot. They're actually a part of it and working towards that end goal. Precisely because of who God is. This is this God who, out of lavish, self-giving love, draws us into His story, who hears us and cares about us and has a plan for all of us in all of these things. Romans 8:28 then gives us the engraving on it to help us understand it. All things working together for good for those who are called by Him. And we're going to see this over and over as Luke's gospel unfolds, how God working, tying all things together according to His sovereign purpose in telling this story. When God acts on a large scale, leading us towards the fulfillment of the age, He takes care of smaller human concerns as well. We don't ever need to look at the things that we're facing and say, well, it's just not important in the larger scheme. No, it is actually part of the whole larger picture that's taking place. We just have to understand that that larger picture is leading towards something that we don't always see or understand at the moment. When this gospel story takes the stage, we realize it's the story of God, it's the story of this world, and it's the story of every human being that He lovingly created and has a plan for in His eternal will. We're coming up on Thanksgiving this week, and I know that because of the circumstances of life and issues that many face here, there's a lot of us who could be sitting here thinking, man, what do I got to be thankful for? Why would I be thankful at this moment? But this is what we learn, that we can be thankful because of the plot, because of the story that's unfolding in this. No matter what we see, we learn from this. God hears. God's heard everything that we've prayed. God's heard every tear we've cried. And God cares. He's not just distantly observing these things impassionately. He cares. He cares about every one of us and what's happening in our lives. And He has a plan. And that's the whole sum of the thing, our hope and our trust that no matter how much it may hurt at the moment, no matter what we can see with our limited scope of view, that He's got a plan at it all, leading us towards that good ending where He puts everything right. He loves us that much that He'll work around even our inability to believe it. Because we say things like that and sometimes it just feels like too much to believe. So like in Zechariah's case, God's willing to work around that. He'll do what's necessary because he loves us that much. That's what we can be thankful for. So that's the backstory. That's the prelude for the story to come. We want to learn from it what we can. We want to hand our disappointments to God and look for his loving purpose to be revealed in the process of it all. To see the world and our lives from the perspective of the bigger plot. Right on? All right. Well, this story is like a warm-up. Luke is kind of like getting us ready with one fantastic story, saying, well, you think that was weird. Just wait till what happens next. That's nuts. So I hope that you're reading along with us. We're going to cover chapter or verses 26 to 38 next time. Get into that and read it. Take the time to look at what this story is saying. See what the Holy Spirit will speak to you in your life, in your part of the story. Okay? All right, cool. Well, if you guys will stand with me, please, if the band wants to come on up here.